Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Should your doctor prescribe a placebo for you instead of conventional medicine? And if she did, would it work? Is the double-blind, placebo-controlled paradigm really the gold standard for medical research? These are just some of the provocative questions I'll discuss with Jeremy Howick, who investigates the mystery of placebos and advocates for changes in the way medicine is researched and practiced today. Welcome to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere you find your podcasts. It's my pleasure to welcome Oxford philosopher and medical researcher Jeremy Howick to the show today to discuss his new book, The Power of Placebo. Jeremy Howick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Renee. It's great to be here with you.
Jeremy, let's start from the beginning. How did you begin to have an interest in placebos, and what sustained your interest through 20 years of research?
Thanks. I used to row competitively, and when you win medals when you're rowing competitively, they sometimes pull you off the podium, make you pee in a bottle, and check if you've taken any banned substances, you know, steroids you shouldn't be taking. Under those circumstances, the coaches are very clear that you should be careful when you take any routine medication, because some people who get positive tests claim, perhaps sometimes true, I don't know, that they were just taking, for example, an allergy medication that their doctor gave them, which led to a positive test result. At the same time, I developed an allergy to a cat my mother bought for my sister. I went to the doctor, they poked me 30 times and confirmed that I was allergic to cats. And they prescribed a nasal spray which had the ingredient corticosteroid in it. I checked very carefully as my coaches instructed me. And I was scared that I couldn't take it for fear of getting tested positive. So I was trying to contact the Sport Canada to find out if it was in fact a banned substance and it would lead to a positive test. Turns out it wouldn't have, but I didn't know. But they were taking their time to reply. In the meantime, my mother suggested I visit a herbal doctor to see if they could help cure my allergies. I didn't believe it would work, but I said, well, it wouldn't hurt perhaps. So I went there to the herbal doctor, expecting crystals on the wall and so on, but it was nothing of the sort. It was just a cleaner than most doctors' offices. And instead of taking 10 minutes or so, we spent 45 minutes discussing not just the allergy symptoms, but also these stresses associated with high-level competitive rowing. In the end, the doctor prescribed a few things. One, she said, wear a hat and scarf, which is frankly just common sense in the winter in Canada. But common sense, as you know, Renee, is not always common. The second thing she said was, drink ginger tea. I didn't believe it would work, but I thought, well, ginger tea couldn't possibly harm me. After all, millions, if not billions of people drink tea with ginger in it across the world. And in fact, I could count it as one of my five fruit and veg a day. So I drank the ginger tea, and within 3 days, my allergy symptoms all but disappeared. That got my geeky mind worrying, and I decided I wanted to find out if ginger tea and things like it could help. You know, answering questions, the main one being, was the ginger tea a placebo, or was there something in it? That led to all kinds of other questions. What counts as good evidence? What is a placebo? And even if ginger tea was a placebo, how would you find out? Because you can't really design a placebo-controlled trial of ginger tea. How do you make something that looks like ginger tea, tastes like ginger tea, smells like ginger tea, but is not ginger tea? That's what got me going. That and a few other things got me going, Renee. I did my PhD in evidence-based medicine, got a job at the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, And now I work at the at a medical school, Leicester Medical School, as well as at Oxford, where we're transforming the medical school curriculum to teach future doctors to communicate better, not to prescribe placebo pills necessarily, but to communicate in ways that will help patients.
Well, Jeremy, as you know, I'm talking to you today from Israel, where the population is under great stress with rockets coming in from Gaza targeting civilian centers, civilians evacuated from parts of the country that are under the greatest attack, and so many families whose loved ones, including babies and little children, are still being held hostage, as well as widespread bereavement. What can you tell us about how placebos might be used to ease the psychological suffering during this war?
Yes, that's obviously a relevant question, almost impossible to avoid. And my position is that I'm against all civilian deaths, including, I'm not comparing the two, but the attacks and the hostages against Israeli civilians are inexcusable, unjustifiable, and
but we're not here to talk about politics. I'm wondering whether in helping people cope with the stress that they're under, can placebos be part of the treatment or the support?
Yes, yes. Oh, thank you for clarifying.
I wouldn't put you in that position.
Well, I should, it's not laughable. So. I wouldn't want to claim that placebos are going to solve the huge problems being faced at the moment. That would be a step too far. If we move to something a bit more general, can placebos help people who are experiencing anxiety in general, depression in general, pain in general? Then the answer is yes. The placebo has been studied more than any other medication in the history of medicine and been shown to have a modest to small average effect for things like pain, depression, anxiety, as well as other things that, you know, functional things as well, immune function and so on. And over the last 20 years, they found out a lot about how placebos work. So the answer to the general question of how can placebos, broadly construed, have a positive influence on emotional distress, then the answer is yes, they can, and they know how that works.
We've always heard that the gold standard for drug research is a placebo-controlled study in which neither patient nor doctor knew who was getting the experimental drug and who was getting a placebo. Explain why you think there's a better standard.
Yes, great question. So if we take, my view is in a way paradoxical. In clinical practice, if you're going to see your doctor in routine practice, in other words, not as part of a clinical trial, then what you want is a doctor who can elicit, who can induce placebo effects, sometimes without, often, more often than not, without placebo pills. We can discuss that in a moment. But if you park routine practice and move into the realm of clinical trials, it's often stated that the gold standard is a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. Now, that is only true if you don't already have an existing treatment. Very sadly, the World Medical Association Declaration of Helsinki used to say that you should not use placebo-controlled trials if there is an existing treatment. But they changed that position later on. Let me explain with an example, a real example. There was we know that steroids can improve survival from alcoholism-induced liver disease. So steroids work for that. They reduce mortality by about 20%. So a new treatment came along for helping to cure and treat alcohol-induced liver disease. But instead of comparing the new treatment to a steroid, they compared the new treatment to a placebo, which means that those patients in the clinical trial who were allocated to the placebo arm were getting worse treatment than they would have if they had compared the new treatment with a known treatment, namely in this case, steroid treatment. they claim this is okay for what they deem to be good methodological reasons, but they don't tell you what those methodological reasons are. And when I've looked into them as part of my research in this area, Renee, I found that there are no good methodological reasons to use a placebo-controlled trial when you have an existing treatment. To use a more lay example, what people want to know isn't which treatment is better than placebo. What they want to know is, from among the available alternatives, which is the best treatment? Just like you'd want to know, you don't want to know which car is best compared to nothing. You want to know which car is best compared to the other cars within your budget range. Does that make sense?
Perfect. Yes. Makes perfect sense. Absolutely. I wonder why we don't do that.
I don't know. Again, they state that it's okay that you can use placebo-controlled trials even when you have an established proven therapy. They say when there are methodological reasons that demand the use of placebos. But then there are no good methodological reasons. Of course, sometimes the supposed established treatment is not really proven, so that sometimes commonly used treatments don't have good evidence. But that doesn't count, right? Because they say that the placebo-controlled trials are okay even if there are established proven treatments. Now, if you were to back me up against the wall and ask me why you do this, I would say that there are commercial interests. And this is without going into any conspiracy theories or anti-capitalist statements. I mean, I like stuff as much as the next person, and I'm grateful for all the stuff I have. That being said, if you had a new treatment, it's much more difficult to show it's better than the existing treatment than it is to show it's better than a placebo. That's my suspicion of why they carry on using placebo-controlled trials. The other reason is oversimplification of medication. So they think that you need to get a pure absolute effect of the drug compared to placebo, but there are too many interactions to get that. Those are my two explanations.
Well, tell us about what makes a powerful placebo. What are some of the factors that enhance a placebo's effectiveness?
So the placebo, like a sugar pill, a small sugar pill, the pill itself does not have an effect. Too much sugar is not good for us, and I'm probably guilty of eating too much of it myself. But the amount of sugar in a small pill is next to negligible. So what causes the effect? If someone takes a sugar pill and their pain, for example, is reduced, it's not the pill, it's their beliefs that are associated with taking the pill, combined or enhanced by the instructions of a trusted empathic clinician, a doctor who tells you this is going to work, this is going to help you. These words from the clinician can, first of all, put the patient at ease. And we know, of course, from a separate body of research that reducing anxiety and inducing relaxation can have all kinds of benefits, from reducing pain and depression to improving immune system function. And then when the patient develops positive expectations, oh, this pill is going to make my back pain go away, that can activate the human body's amazing inner pharmacy. And that's not an exaggeration to say that the human body does have a pharmacy. It would be an exaggeration to claim that the pharmacy can cure everything. That's not what I'm saying. But you can produce endorphins and dopamine. And of course, endorphin is just the combination of two words, endogenous, which means made by the body, and morphine. So the stuff people shoot up on the street, morphine, is almost identical to the morphine that your body makes, endorphins. Hope I've answered your question.
Yes, absolutely. You mentioned in the book that there are some other aspects about how the placebo is presented. For example, if it's more invasive or having to do with the color and the size and the branding of a pill. And it made me think about some of the popular medications now. For example, the obesity medications. They're actually diabetes medications, but they're being used for weight loss, that have a lot of what you call in the book ritual to it. They have to be refrigerated. They are invasive. They're a shot, not an injection. So talk about that a little bit. I found that fascinating.
So that's an important point. So that's one reason why people don't like, when patents run out, they move to the generic version. And the generic version of Prozac, for example, is fluoxetine. Now, Prozac sounds much more powerful than fluoxetine because it was designed to sound powerful. Pro sounds positive. When you use the word Zed, it sounds powerful. This is what psychologists, you probably know more about than I do, but they developed the name on purpose to sound like it's going to work. Whereas the generic drug, they often find that the generics don't work as well, although they're identical chemically to the patented versions. When they did a test once with painkillers, some of them had a brand name, others were generic names. The brand name works better. They've done another trial with more expensive painkillers that costed $2.50 compared to ones that costed 10 cents each. The more expensive ones worked. And this is replicated in expensive restaurants. I mean, they turn the lights down low, they make you wait a long time for your food. But at the end of the day, how much better does it taste than your mom's home cooking or a good burger or pizza? I might be going a bit too far there if you're a gourmet, and I apologize for that.
No, but I agree. A lot of the appreciation and the enjoyment of food is in the presentation. I think that's a very good comparison. Yeah.
Yes. And then in terms of invasiveness, of course, the least invasive is a pill. And the most invasive is surgery. So placebo surgery is a full ritual. They even call the surgical theater a theater. The surgeons are the most eminent, skilled, looked up to people in the hospital. I mean, they command people. And I'm not denigrating them, by the way. I've got some friends who are phenomenal surgeons. I could never do what they do. I couldn't even imagine doing the amazing things they do for human beings. So none of this is against what doctors do. I want to make that point clear. It's just that we can use placebo effects to enhance what we're doing with modern medicine. So the surgical theater involves the letting of blood. Now, whether someone's religious or not, the letting of blood in Judeo-Christian religions is very meaningful. It's impossible to escape that meaning. Someone's lying in a prone position. They allow the surgeon to cut them. So this invasive procedure can induce powerful placebo effects. And most surgery is not a placebo, but some of it is. I'll give you two examples. They did a trial. A doctor in Harvard was doing vertebroplasty. So to fix broken vertebrae, so nothing, you know, psychosomatic. They do an X-ray. There's a crack in one of the vertebrae, and they do something called vertebroplasty, which involves injecting cement, a kind of glue, to glue it back together. So with one patient, a very clever doctor did the procedure. The patient got better, came back for their checkup 6 weeks later. The doctor checked and realized he made a mistake. He injected the cement into the wrong vertebra, not the one that was broken, but it still worked. So he did a full trial comparing, you know, real vertebroplasty where you inject some cement compared to fake vertebroplasty where you just poke the person with a needle in the back but don't inject any glue. The fake one worked as well as the real one for low back pain. Other trials have replicated this with knee surgery, for example, where they can see mechanical damage. And this is a point that brings up an important point with placebos, that people think, oh, it's just psychological. And nothing is just psychological, not a single thing. Anything you think, you can view it there's something happens in your brain. So these mechanical things, severe knee problems, back issues that you can see on an X-ray can be helped by placebo treatments.
That's amazing. So what percentage, I don't know if you can estimate this, but what percentage of every medicine's effectiveness is due to the placebo effect?
So earlier on, a famous American doctor called Henry Knowles Beecher claimed that about a third was due to the placebo effect on average. His was an overestimate because he looked at the response after a placebo and counted that as a placebo effect, which is a mistake. Of course, I mean, I might have a headache and then take a placebo and my headache might go away. It's not necessarily because of the placebo. After that, in 2001, some Danish skeptics and fantastic researchers, Hrobjartsen and Goetje, looked at trials that had compared what happened to people who took a placebo with what happened with people who didn't take any treatment at all, and found there was almost no placebo effect. And they corrected Beecher's error, but in doing so, it introduced an error of their own. The main error was ignoring heterogeneity. So for some things, even in their skeptical study, placebos did have statistically significant effects, not as big as Beecher's. The second thing is, there's no such thing as an untreated group. I mean, if you're in a clinical trial and they don't give you anything, you still get the follow-up, you get the communication with a doctor, you get leaflets, you might start treating yourself because they're measuring you and so on. And these things would tend to lead to an underestimate. So the truth is somewhere in the middle. It's the placebo, the average placebo effect of medications. The answer is, on average, it's not huge, and it depends on what condition we're talking about.
Can you say more about that? What conditions are more placebo and what are less?
The most studied condition is pain, back pain, knee pain, osteoarthritis pain, and they've known how placebos work in that area for years now. They did some great studies showing that they gave a bunch of people placebos, but they gave some of them an opioid antagonist, so a drug that would that prevents opiates from working. And those who had the opioid antagonist did not experience placebo effects, whereas those who did not have the antagonists did. So the way placebo painkiller works is by activating the body's inner pharmacy to produce endorphins. That's a very simplistic explanation. With depression and anxiety, it's similar. The placebos activate the body's inner pharmacy. Those are the things it works the best. But even for things like knee pain and back pain, where there is a physical damage, the placebo surgery can activate the body's wound healing cascade. So given the message that something's happened there, the body does physical things, more blood vessels, tissue that can help repair things. But so to answer your question, pain, anxiety, depression are they work quite well for those in most people. Then if you go to there are some more radical anecdotes, which we can't confirm that they're evidence-based, where people, recover from very serious illnesses following from placebo treatments. The most famous example perhaps is Mr. Wright, who had tumors and received a medication called Crebiotzin, which he believed powerfully would cure him. And then he took the medication and his tumors allegedly shrank. But then he found out that it was a quack remedy and they came back. But again, these are anecdotes. We shouldn't put too much stock in them. But to answer your question, pain is the most important, most common condition, most evidence-based condition. But there are other ones as well. Placebo treatments have been shown to influence immune function, and other physical things you can measure.
There's a remarkable point that you make in the book, which is that you don't have to lie to patients when you use a placebo. They sometimes, or often, I don't know which, improve even when they know they're taking a sugar pill. Talk about the examples you bring in the book.
Yes. So the common objection to using placebo pills in routine practice, so not clinical trials, but your doctor you see on a regular basis, is that it would involve deception. You must lie to the patient, say this is a powerful treatment, when in fact it's a sugar pill. I've done a meta-analysis of trials where they've given people placebos and told them it's a placebo, saying things like, here is a This is a sugar pill. It's a placebo pill, like a sugar pill, that has been known to help some patients like you due to mind-body self-healing processes, and that they have control groups where people don't get anything at all. And sometimes these seem to be almost as powerful as deceptive placebos. In one dramatic example, Linda Buonono had such bad IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, she could barely leave her house. She took the open label placebo as part of a trial, got better for the first time in years. And at the end of the trial, they no longer gave her the placebos. Her IBS came back. She went to the doctor to ask for some placebos by name. They said, no, we can't give you those. It's unethical. So these are some examples where open label placebo works. But I go even a step further. Placebo effects, Renee. Like I said, the effect of the placebo is not because of the ingredients in the pill. It's because of the communication of the healthcare practitioner, the doctor, the surgeon. So this communication, this positive, empathic communication can be used without a pill. And in fact, because it does work, because it does help patients, I think it's an ethical requirement for doctors to engage in empathic, positive communication. I also believe that that you can give open label placebos in some cases. For example, you know, IBS, until recently there wasn't anything that really worked. Why not try an open label placebo if people are willing to take it? Another example is post-operative pain. People take painkillers after their operations. A small fraction of them develop dependence to painkillers, and this can be terrible, lead to terrible things, including, for again, a small proportion of those, death. Why not replace half the painkillers with placebos and tell the patients, ask them if they're willing to, if that could reduce the chances of becoming dependent but have the similar painkilling effect, and this would have to be shown, by the way, why not try it? Yet another example, communication for antibiotics are overprescribed, way overprescribed. Some doctors claim that they do a test on the patient. They've discovered that the patient's illness is caused by a viral infection. They know absolutely that the antibiotics can have no effect on a viral infection by definition. Yet the patient insists. In those circumstances, why could a doctor not ask the patient if they're willing to try an open label placebo? So I think there are circumstances. So I think that the positive empathic communication should be ethically required. And there are some more limited circumstances where an open label or honest placebo could, and I think should, be at least tried more seriously.
So you explained that there are characteristics of the healthcare setting and the physician-patient relationship and characteristics of the placebo itself and the environment that impact the power of a placebo. What about a personality or other individual characteristics of the patient? Are there some people who are more likely to respond to placebo?
That's a great question that I often get, because I work in a university setting where people are much better educated than the average. And they usually tell me, Jeremy, you know, a placebo wouldn't really work for me because that's for a suggestible, uneducated educated people. And they've tried for decades to identify characteristics of placebo responders, and they basically failed. And as proof that they've failed, drug companies still use what they call placebo run-in periods. They give a bunch of people a placebo to find out who responds to a placebo, and they exclude those who respond to placebos in order to, you could say, in my view, inflate the effect of the drug. Now, if they could predict who would respond to the placebo, they wouldn't have to spend the money on the placebo run-in periods. That being said, there have been some recent limited studies showing that people who are more suggestible, so people who are empirically more likely to be hypnotizable, could be more, responsible, more responsive to placebos. But overall, it's been a dead-end research avenue.
Finally, Jeremy, you argue that fee-for-service healthcare fails because it doesn't incentivize patient outcomes and it disincentivizes spending time with patients. What system of healthcare would you prefer to see?
Yes, fee-for-service. The more tests and treatments a healthcare provider provides, the more money they make. So they're incentivized. I'm not saying that's their only motivation, but they are factually incentivized by treating a lot. And you should know that iatrogenic deaths are the third leading cause of death in the U.S. So we take too much medicine. I think few would deny that. Most people in the Western world, developed countries, take too much medicine. The alternative is value-based healthcare, where people are reimbursed based on real patient outcomes. And there are examples of this. For example, Kaiser Permanente separates the provider from the payer. So they're all working together. Let me explain you using a story, which is perhaps an oversimplification, but provides your listeners with an idea of what could happen and what is happening in some areas, such as Kaiser Permanente doing a great job. I'm not getting paid by them, by the way. So in ancient China, allegedly, I haven't found a historical source, but it's often reported that in ancient China, doctors would be paid a retainer. So you give them a monthly fee as long as you are healthy. The moment you fell ill, you stopped paying the doctor. This made the interest of the patient's health, directly aligned with the doctor's payment. So then it becomes in the doctor's interest to make the patient healthy. So you can see what the doctor would do in those circumstances. They'd encourage lifestyle changes that would preclude the need for treatments. And when they decided to give tests and treatments, only those that were going to lead to improved patient health, not those that were unnecessary. So, and this kind of system is called, value-based healthcare, and it is cropping up in places like the UK, the US. There are, of course, big challenges with it. So if this kind of thing happens, doctors will be incentivized to only take healthy patients. But there are ways to overcome that by requiring that they deal with a specific catchment area, for example.
The book is The Power of Placebos. Thanks so much for talking with me today, Jeremy.
Renee, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.